Hello there, Peabody here. Once again, it is time to take another revealing peek back into history.
What famous date shall I set it to today, Mr. Peabody?
All the way back to 2009 and Ruination, the early years.
Imagine, if you will, just the sheer logistics of juggling 75 wildly unpredictable party guests. You know, you're acting as the primary security guard trying to police the doors to keep out all these freeloading gatecrashers.
Oh man, that sounds like a nightmare.
Right. And while you're doing that, you are manually counting over $1,000 in charity cash and like tracking bids on leather gear.
Just a casual weekend activity.
Totally. And somehow, amidst all of this, you are surviving a completely unhinged drink and drown tea dance. Like feeling like you are starring in a Broadway bender, only to wake up the very next morning without a single trace of a hangover.
I mean, it sounds less like a weekend itinerary and more like a chaotic sociological experiment. But that was actually someone's reality. A deeply exhausting, surprisingly philanthropic, and incredibly sticky few days.
And that is exactly the brand of chaos we are unpacking for you today. I'm King.
And I'm Dale.
Welcome to Ruination, the early years. Our mission for you today, as we dive into the archives, is to summarize the month of September 2009 in the big fatty online universe.
Yeah, and if we are tracking the emotional arc of this specific month, we are looking at a period where sheer physical exhaustion violently collides with a desperate need for control.
It really does. I mean, we've got petty hostage negotiations over a voicemail, bizarre reality TV fixations, and a kitchen gadget that literally explodes.
That need for control is the really fascinating part, I think.
Yeah.
Because September 2009 kicks off with a massive deficit of it.
Oh, definitely.
He returns from this massive Labor Day weekend event in Augusta, known as the Horror Hotel.
Yeah.
And the tone of just absolute bone deep exhaustion from this single weekend essentially bleeds into everything he does for the rest of the month.
Yeah. He gets on the microphone right after the weekend and declares he is, quote, woo, tired.
Tired. That is so funny.
Which is a huge understatement when you actually look at the itinerary of what he was doing as the secretary treasurer of this event. I mean, he is managing the registration for those 75 paid attendees. He is acting as the de facto police force to ward off people trying to sneak in and snag free cocktails. And amidst all of that logistical nightmare, he still manages to find time to host gentlemen callers on Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday.
It is a profound expenditure of social and physical energy. But what really stands out in the archival sources beyond the tea dances and the gentleman callers is the silent auction.
Oh, yeah. The auction was wild.
They raised an impressive $1,269 for charity.
And the items auctioned off are just a perfect snapshot of this specific community in 2009. You have bids ranging from $11 to $200 on items that include a jacket, leather chaps, and a literal leather jockstrap.
Wait, a leather jockstrap?
Yes, and it was hand-delivered by two very dedicated attendees who flew all the way in from Massachusetts just for this event.
Wow, that is dedication. But, you know, it's easy to hear leather jockstrap at a charity auction and just laugh it off as niche party antics. The impact of that money completely recontextualizes the entire weekend, though.
How so?
Well, the sources detail how the previous Christmas, this exact same group used their auction funds to adopt a struggling family.
Oh, right. Yeah, I saw that. It was a family where the parents had lost their jobs right before the holidays.
Exactly. And this group of partygoers bought them a Christmas tree, a turkey with all the trimmings, presents for the kids, and even rented a limousine to take the family through a local festival of lights.
It's just so heartwarming. It really forces you to look past the surface level of the event.
Yeah.
Like, beneath the wild parties, the drink and drown afternoons, and the leather gear, there is this highly organized engine of genuine community support.
It's an insulated ecosystem taking care of people outside of it.
It's incredible. But of course, the weekend ultimately wraps up with that Sunday afternoon dog tag tea dance. He gets so inebriated, he compares himself to the famously drunken character Vera Charles on Any Given Sunday.
Naturally.
Crashes into bed at 10 p.m. and then miraculously wakes up Monday morning with zero hangover.
The biological resilience is astonishing, sure. But the psychological toll is what really sets the stage for the rest of September.
I've been trying to wrap my head around that. Because managing this entire weekend sounds exactly like being a frantic backstage manager at a highly chaotic theater production.
Oh, totally.
You know, you're constantly putting out fires, you're herding cats, you're dealing with big personalities. How does someone who spends his highly controlled, usually isolated daily life back in the Fat Cave studio actually process this intense in-person weekend?
Well, the short answer is he doesn't process it well.
Yeah.
That is the core tension of September. His daily life is a meticulously curated routine. He sits alone in his studio. He controls the microphone. He completely controls the narrative. The horror hotel weekend strips away every ounce of that control.
Because he has to deal with real people.
Exactly. He is forced to react to other people's chaos. And that massive expenditure of social energy completely drains him.
So he survives the weekend. He wakes up without a hangover. He's allegedly invincible. How long does that last before the bill comes due?
It doesn't last at all. He crashes hard.
Mm-hmm.
He is so wiped out that he actually has to break his own rigid broadcasting rules just to survive the week.
Wait, what does he do?
He needs a substitute host to keep his flawless daily publishing streak alive.
Oh, right. And he turns to someone who immediately polarizes the entire audience. Auntie Vera.
Or, as he insists on calling her with relentless consistency, the Sea Hag.
Yes, the Sea Hag.
So she steps in and actually records the Thursday, Friday, and Monday shows to cover for his exhaustion. And the audience reaction fractures almost instantly.
I bet.
On one side, you have Brother Sinus, who is literally writing in from a religious cloister in Denver.
Wait, really? A cloister?
Yeah. And he praises the episode, saying the two of them produced wonderful and slightly informative shows together.
I love that slightly informative is considered high praise in this ecosystem.
Right. But then on the other side of the spectrum, you have the loyalists who entirely reject the substitute. We hear from a new listener named Melissa calling in from California, and she makes what turns out to be a fatal error.
Oh, no. What does she do?
She gets caught in the crossfire. She admits she actually loves Auntie Vera and flat out refuses to use the derogatory Sea Hag nickname.
She just won't do it.
Nope.
And in response, he jokingly but very swiftly sentences Melissa to the Fat Cave Punishment Center.
Straight to the Punishment Center.
But hold on, is this just standard podcast banter or is there something deeper happening here? Because to me, it just sounds like a host having fun with a new listener, you know?
I would argue it's a very calculated power play. Think about the psychology here. When he stepped away, the audience got a taste of a different authority figure.
Okay, yeah.
They had a few days of someone else driving the car. By strictly punishing Melissa, even in jest, for refusing to use his proprietary insult, he is reestablishing the rules of his universe.
You know what this reminds me of? It's exactly like when you have a substitute teacher in third grade.
Oh, that's a perfect analogy.
The kids go totally feral for 2 days, and when the real teacher comes back, they have to slam a heavy textbook on the desk and hand out a detention just to prove who is actually in charge of the room.
Exactly. He is reminding them, I am back, and we speak my language here. If you want to participate in the community, you have to adopt the vocabulary he mandates.
Okay, but punishing a listener over a nickname is pretty low-stakes drama. If the punishment center was him testing his grip on the steering wheel, he completely floors the gas later in the month.
He really does.
He initiates what can only be described as an actual audio hostage crisis.
The Jeremiah voicemail. This is a fascinating study in digital community dynamics and manufactured scarcity.
He receives a voicemail that is over 4 minutes long from a notorious regular caller named Jeremiah. But instead of just playing it on the show like he normally would, he refuses.
He just sits on it.
Yeah, he holds the audio file hostage for days, demanding that Jeremiah call back with more scandalous or juicy details before he will release the original audio to the public.
And the community goes into an absolute frenzy over a voicemail they haven't even heard.
See, I don't fully get this. It's a rambling 4-minute voicemail from a random caller, not a lost Beatles track, you know?
All right.
Isn't dragging this out just annoying the listeners? Like a television network deliberately stretching a cliffhanger season finale into the next year just to boost ratings?
You would think it would annoy them to the point of tuning out, but look at the actual reaction. By artificially withholding a piece of content, he inflates its value astronomically.
So it's all about the hype.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A regular 4-minute voicemail from Jeremiah is standard background noise, but a banned 4-minute voicemail, suddenly it's the Holy Grail.
I guess that's true because you have a listener named Bill who claims the title of the number one fan, actively threatening to quit listening entirely if the voicemail isn't played. Then there's Straight Bob, the international straight boyfriend tuning in from Australia, leaving a message calling the hostage situation not normal.
It becomes a global crisis.
It really does.
You have Brian in Denver, begging to hear the voicemail just so he can get through his grueling Labor Day work shift. And Drunky Mike from Virginia is ominously hovering in the wings, ready to strike. It gives the community a unified mission.
And then you have the fiercely loyal defenders. Listener Julie steps in to violently defend the host's decision to withhold the audio.
Oh, Julie was not having it.
Not at all. She starts berating the whiners in the audience, literally asking if they think they pay his salary or if they were raised in a barn. She acts as his aggressive PR surrogate.
Which proves the tactic worked. He transformed passive listening into highly active, combative participation. He eventually caves, of course.
Right. He releases the full audio on the September 30th episode, resolving the month-long standoff. But what is so striking to me is the massive contrast between these highly orchestrated psychological games he plays with his listeners and the incredibly mundane, stressful reality of his actual day job.
Oh, the day job is a completely different world.
Yeah, he is a commanding puppet master on the microphone, but at the coal mine, his nickname for his workplace, he is entirely at the mercy of the corporate structure.
The inversion of control is stark. At work, there are ominous rumors swirling about furloughs and firings. His livelihood is genuinely threatened.
And how does he process that threat? He talks about surviving a skeleton staff Friday, not because of layoffs yet, but because all of his coworkers took off to attend some hootenanny in North Carolina.
Hootenanny.
A hootenanny. But instead of focusing on the looming furloughs, he hyperfixates on these bizarre micro details of office life.
Yeah, he notes a coworker named Larry H. Vader installing the new Snow Leopard operating system on his Computra.
Right, the Computra. And he gives a highly detailed, granular review of an I Love Lucy-themed office luncheon.
Oh my goodness, the luncheon.
Specifically evaluating the Cuban sandwiches and coconut rice pudding. He also takes great joy in noting that this luncheon was blissfully missing a coworker they mutually despise, known only as the Skull.
The Skull. It's all about finding small victories when you have no structural power. He even celebrates that his vehicle property tax for his Ford Explosion was exactly $215.88.
He's hyperfixated on Cuban sandwiches and tax bills down to the penny while his actual job is on the line. And then he goes home and completely escapes this corporate anxiety by obsessively consuming reality television.
And his reality TV consumption isn't passive at all. It's practically academic.
It really is. He is lamenting that college football preempted the finale of Big Brother. He's highly invested in the cast. Like, he desperately wants Kevin to win, and he actively hates Natalie.
He has strong opinions.
Very. Then he turns to a show called Tool Academy, which he delightfully describes as a white trash testosterone fest.
But his analysis of Survivor Samoa is where you really see this need for order and categorization taking over.
I wanted to ask you about this because he meticulously evaluates the male contestants on Survivor. Mm. He doesn't just list their names.
No, he goes deep.
He catalogs Ben, a 23-year-old with wispy hair named Brett, a 62-year-old personal chef named Mike, the confusing presence of two different guys named Russell, and a rocket scientist named John.
It's so specific.
Why does he care about the exact age of a personal chef on an island while almost completely dismissing the very real threat of furloughs at his own job?
Well, it's a textbook coping mechanism for a lack of agency. Think about his position at the coal mine.
Right. He has no control.
Exactly. Zero control. He can't stop a corporate furlough.
Yeah.
He can't even control if the Skull shows up to ruin the Cuban sandwich luncheon. But when he sits on his couch and watches Survivor, he's the ultimate judge, jury, and executioner.
He is back in the driver's seat.
Precisely. He can categorize, critique, label, and dismiss these people from the absolute safety of his living room. Organizing the chaotic reality of strangers on a television screen gives him a profound sense of order that his actual professional life completely lacks right now.
That makes so much sense. It's a pressure valve. And he applies that same critical eye to everything he watches. He even critiques a pitch on Shark Tank by an elderly couple selling $24.95 airtight underpants.
Oh, the underpants.
Yes. Underpants equipped with a charcoal filter directly by the butthole to contain flatulence.
The spectrum of his media consumption is truly vast.
From fart underpants to a genuinely sincere tribute to the late Patrick Swayze. Mm. Like, he plays the theme from the North and South miniseries, specifically noting it was filmed in Charleston.
That's quite the tonal shift.
Very much so.
Yeah.
But as much as he tries to meticulously categorize these TV shows to maintain control, you can't live in a reality TV bubble forever. Eventually, reality itself starts to get a little weird.
Yeah, the real world creeps in.
The absurdity he seeks out on television perfectly mirrors the absurdity of the universe around him in September. Everything is just slightly off kilter.
The dates and the memories alone set a very weird tone for the month. September 9th, or 09-09-09, is officially dubbed Spooky Day.
Spooky Day.
Yeah, he jokes that the date means the devil is standing on his head.
And then September 21st rolls around, marking the 20th anniversary of Hurricane Hugo. And instead of focusing on the broad historical destruction of the storm, he vividly recalls the highly specific sensory details.
Like what?
He talks about the smell of sawdust everywhere from the downed trees, and the very distinct smell of everyone in the neighborhood cooking their thawing meat on BBQ grills because the power grid was completely wiped out.
Yeah. Those grounded sensory details are what make these archival sources so rich, and the community surrounding him is right there matching this strange energy step for step.
Oh, absolutely. You have Farmer and Pokey sending him an audio file of a flatulence song recorded from a 1970s Mad magazine.
Fitting, considering the Shark Tank underpants.
Exactly. Then there's Phil, the self-proclaimed Oregon dude. Phil writes in to reveal that he grew up incredibly sheltered and homophobic in Nebraska, but now he is a dedicated straight fan of the show.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and Big Fatty is so thrilled by this that he jokingly offers to make Phil his domestic straight boyfriend.
But he has to immediately retract the offer.
Right. Out of sheer fear of angering straight Bob, his existing straight boyfriend in Australia, the podcast diplomacy here is incredibly delicate.
And highly volatile. Yeah. Let's not forget Gumbo Guy, the raging Cajun.
Oh, right. What happened with him?
He briefly disappears from the community simply because he is angry over Big Fatty mispronouncing a term as Brick Friday.
Are you serious? Just over a mispronunciation?
Yep. The community is chaotic, but nothing fights his need for control quite as hard as his own technology.
The universe was actively working against his hardware in 2009. A listener named Turniped points out that if you search for the Little Fatty Podcast on the Apple iTunes platform, the algorithm inexplicably brings up search results for little girl and tuberculosis.
Which is a terrifying glimpse into how the algorithms operated in the Wild West of 2009.
Completely broken. But the crowning technological disaster of the month, the moment where chaos truly wins, has to be the SodaStream.
Oh, the SodaStream incident.
He buys a SodaStream appliance from Kohl's, attempts to make the diet pink grapefruit flavor, and the machine violently squirts and explodes sticky syrup all over his kitchen.
It is a spectacular sticky disaster. But, you know, it raises an interesting point about his appeal.
Because every piece of technology, from the massive corporate Apple iTunes directory to a simple countertop carbonation machine, seems to actively fight him.
Yeah.
Do you think the community loves him because of these spectacular failures rather than despite them?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. Think about the alternative. If he were a perfectly polished broadcaster who effortlessly operated a flawless SodaStream, never got exhausted from a charity event, and gracefully mastered the iTunes algorithm, he would be untouchable. He would be sterile.
Like listening to a corporate press release.
Exactly. But because he is constantly at war with his own appliances, and because he is willing to share the sticky, messy aftermath of those battles with his audience, he becomes profoundly human.
That's a great point.
The audience doesn't just relate to his failures. They feel a sense of protective kinship over him. They want to see him win against the SodaStream because they are fighting their own metaphorical SodaStreams every day.
So, summarizing this incredible month of September 2009 in the BFO universe, we are looking at a strange, beautiful whiplash. You have a man who opens his month managing a wildly successful charity auction to buy a struggling family a Christmas tree, and ends his month holding a voicemail hostage from a global audience while dodging exploding grapefruit syrup in his kitchen.
It is the full spectrum of the human experience compressed into daily audio dispatches.
It really is. We want to thank you for sitting at the table with us today and exploring these archives. Please come back next Saturday for another month of Ruination, the early years.
And remember to tune in each Sunday for Ruination Repeat, which recaps last week's current BFO episodes.
But before we go, we want to leave you with a final thought to ponder. We just spent a lot of time discussing how an entire global community went to war over a substitute host, held their collective breath over a delayed 4-minute voicemail, and found profound joy in a pair of airtight flatulence underpants.
A bizarre list of events.
Truly. So, what does it actually say about our fundamental human need for connection that in an increasingly isolated world, we will so fiercely band together to find meaning in the most beautifully trivial, mundane details of a stranger's life?
That is a great question to take with you.
I'm King.
And I'm Gail.
Thanks for joining us. We will see you next time.
Well, we hope you enjoyed today's trip down memory lane on Ruination the Early Years. Join us again next weekend. We'll see you then.